Hello and welcome back to the Stop Stressing Me Out podcast. Today on the podcast, we're talking all about engagement. Now, we're talking on our series about workplace well-being. So this isn't engagement, I got a bright shiny ring on my finger. This is engagement. What does engagement look like in the workplace? How can we better measure it? And what do we actually need from those engagement surveys in order to assess stress and well-being in the workplace? Joining me for this conversation today is Denise Lloyd, the founder and CEO of Engaged, an award-winning Victoria-based human resource consulting firm that provides leading-edge HR services to organizations across Canada. Denise is a leader that brings new ideas and innovation to the way HR contributes to an organization and is known for transforming workplaces. Denise has over 25 years of HR experience and has a Master of Arts in Leadership and holds the prestigious designation of Fellow Chartered Human Resources Professional. Now, I first got to know Denise through the Disrupt HR series and absolutely love what they're doing over there, which we talk about a little bit in this episode. So in the episode, we talk a bit about her career journey, and then we really dive into engagement surveys today. What are the different types of surveys we do, from engagement to pulse to culture? What's the difference? What's the frequency you ideally want to do that? And then we dive into organizational readiness. How do you know when you're ready to conduct one of these surveys, and more importantly, to carry out the work that you need to do in order to make them a success and to get the outcomes you want for your organization? We also talk about when there's organizations who are experiencing a high level of stress, what her recommendations are when it comes to assessing the root cause of that, especially when stress can come from so many different aspects of an organization. Finally, we talk a little bit about those frontline managers who can sometimes feel like they're caught between a rock and a hard place. We talk about how they can actually use the results of those surveys to make a difference on their own team, even if the organization as a whole isn't taking on big steps and leaps in improving their workplace well-being. So I think it's a really interesting conversation, and I hope that you enjoy it as much as I do. So without further ado, let's head into the interview. Well, thank you so much, Denise, for joining me on the podcast. I'm so pleased to have you.
Thank you, Victoria. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to start with a question I ask all my guests. What is stressing you out this week? Big, small, whatever you want to share.
Right. Well, and I'm sure it's different every time you ask me, it'll be different. It's interesting, in our business, Mondays and Fridays are busy. And you think those are the days that aren't going to be, but they are. And so today being Friday, it is a busy day. Everybody wants to get everything off their plate and pass it on to our plates before the weekend. So it's been a busy day.
Well, we are honored to have you join us for the hour. I really appreciate it. What's stressing me out this week, I feel like it always ties back to my children whenever I share these, but spring break is coming up. So I'm just very acutely aware that next week is like the get everything done. So just feels like a ticking time bomb, and someone's going to be sick and that'll throw everything out the window. But that's life, right?
That's how it goes. Yep, absolutely.
So I'm hoping you can start our listeners off with a bit of a rough outline of like what your career journey has looked like and how you've ended up doing what you're doing today.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. My career journey is long and but has real theme to it of working in HR and working around the workplace and helping people, in leading people in some way. And so I started out in employment and career training and started doing work, helping people find jobs, writing resumes, doing job search and career planning type organizational, kind of how do you want to contribute to the world, and helping people figure that out. And worked in nonprofit organizations for about 15 years in that sector and in all of those different arenas as executive director, and then decided that I wanted some corporate experience. So I then went into working for a global technology company and was director of HR and administration for an ERP software, so enterprise resource management, basically financial software, and did that for a number of years, and then realized that selling financial software wasn't really my light me up every day kind of thing. And I missed working with small organizations. This was a global company. And so I was a part of a really large team, and I wanted to be more grassroots and back on the ground with, decided to start Engaged HR, and really wanted to bring all that I had learned, the best of both worlds, everything about really values-based approach to work and people from the nonprofit sector, and how to do a lot with a very little amount of money, and all of the really good business practices, and taking a look at the business side of work and all the learnings that I had there and working with the tech company and the private sector, wanted to bring those two things together to support organizations that needed the support of HR, but didn't need it full time, didn't have the money for full time, but really needed the support. And so created Engaged HR. We've recently rebranded to Engaged, and really wanted to bring really great HR practices into small and medium sized business and nonprofit organizations in a really different way that wasn't available in other ways for them. So it was been a great journey to create an organization and a company that is able to work with hundreds of organizations that need some help. They don't need full-time help, but they need some help. And so just being able to really be in that place of servant leadership and to be able to offer support to so many organizations has really brought me to where I am today.
And I just kudos to you for, you know, building the organization that you have, the number of organizations that you support, the size of your team. And I first sort of was exposed to what Engage do through Disrupt HR. So these
Yes.
talks that happen all around the world. It was such a phenomenal event with incredible thought leaders. So no, and I having planned events in the past, I know it's no small feat what you put together. So it's a fantastic event. I can't wait for the next one.
Yes. Disrupt is a, it's a, it was totally a random thing. I happened upon it I guess it was 2016, happened upon it online as like, this is kind of cool. And so we immediately bought the rights to Disrupt HR Victoria. So we are part of a global initiative that brings speakers together. Was once a year. And then of course we took a break during the pandemic, but we're back on track to once a year to have, as you say, thought leadership on the stage about how we need to shake things up, do things differently. You know, really take a very different view of how do we work with people in our organizations, which is what Engaged is all about. So it was just the perfect fit for us to be able to sponsor that event.
Yeah. And for those that don't know, it's basically like TED Talks on HR
yeah.
topics. Like it was, they're short enough that you really hold everyone's attention, but also get you thinking. And, you know, I went home that night just be like, oh, all the different ways and ChatGPT and all the stuff.
The
so
things.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. We've done five of them now. And it really is that, what is your core message? What is that core disruptive thought that you want to change the world with in terms of how people are at work? And it's a fabulous event.
Love it. Well, I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah.
Today, we're here to talk about engagement surveys, though.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those, like, it could be a really boring topic, but I also think it's one of those things where employees receive these on an annual or whatever kind of cadence they receive them. And I think for many people, they can take so long to put in, they put in a lot of effort, and then they wonder what happens with it or how it was designed or why it was even structured the way it was to begin with. And then how that data is disseminated and how it's used. Like there's just so many aspects to it that impact our well-being and how we are engaged in the workplace. So I really want to dive into that with you. And I thought maybe we could just start with the basics for folks of, we hear about engagement surveys, pulse surveys, culture surveys. What is the core difference between them? And what is maybe the cadence that you would do those at?
Mm-hmm. So the easy one to pull out of that list is the pulse survey. So a pulse survey is sometimes also called a net promoter score,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you're basically, you've got like one number or a happy face or a sad face or a neutral face. You've got one moment in time that you're getting a sense of how are things going. And it's very quick. It's a click of a button. You're not answering a bunch of questions. You're not thinking that hard, very in the moment. And that's to give you a sense of, in the moment, how are people doing?
Yeah.
And so they have a place for sure in organizational development to understand how are things going. It can be great after a meeting. How was that meeting for you? Happy, sad, neutral. It can be used like, how was your day? At the end of the day, complete this pulse survey. Engagement surveys and culture, what we call culture assessments, Those are a bit different in that they're much more in depth. They are the other terminology you might hear is job satisfaction surveys. They're really to look at multifaceted elements of how are people feeling in the workplace. And engagement surveys are more focused on how are you feeling about your connection to the organization on, anywhere from 5 to 10 different factors. And it can be very in depth, and it can be multiple choice. It can be rating surveys like 1 to 5. And it can also include free text questions where you can provide some thought. And then there's culture assessments, which is a bit more focused on like external to you. It's more about the environment. It's more about your external to how you're doing, but how's the culture overall? And so it's a has a different sort of tenor to it, and outcomes in terms of what your collection of information that you're gathering. What they all have in common is that they're telling you something. And from that story that you're getting out of that information, you then informs leaders or managers, working groups, advisory councils. I mean, there's many different ways these can be managed, but it informs the organization on what's working, what's not working, what's neutral in the organization, and maybe you don't want it to be neutral. Like it's telling you a story. And so that's where there's value in collecting that information. And you have to be really intentional in terms of what questions you ask, making sure that it's not a necessarily an open forum, but that you're, getting your information in a targeted way so that you can then do something with it. But they really range in style and, process. Is it multiple choice? Is it a rating scale? Is it, are you asking 12 questions? Are you asking 2 questions? There's a million different ways that it can look and feel, but those are the kind of the crux of the differences that exist between those three.
So if we're looking at workplace well-being in general, that would typically be the engagement survey and maybe that pulse to sort of check here and there where we're at.
They all have a role in workplace well-being. That would be definitely appropriate on the engagement and pulse side. The culture survey will tell you more about some of the bigger picture elements, which can have a huge impact on well-being. So they all have a role to play in understanding the cadence of well-being. So an example might be that in an engagement survey, you might be able to determine that you've got some burnout happening from people, but in a culture assessment, you might be able to determine that you've got some systemic barriers to how work is assigned or to workload management or time management, which contributes to how they're feeling, which contributes to their burnout. And so they go together and they tell you a story from both perspectives about the same topic, which is well-being.
No, that makes a lot more sense. And in terms of timing, then, if you kind of need the information from both, but you don't want to survey people to death, what's your kind of recommendation for organizations on how to space those out?
Yeah, and they don't have to be separate. Like you can incorporate questions from both perspectives into a survey. And so call it what you want. But to give you both the internal, how are the people doing, and the external, how's the environment doing, you can get both of that in one survey versus doing two, because you're right, you want to be very careful of survey fatigue and overloading the end user of completing the survey, but also too much information can also be paralyzing. And so doing both surveys gives you like a lot of information that you might not be able to move the needle on anything because it's too overwhelming. And from a cadence point of view, it really is about being strategic and how often do you do things, because your first one is your benchmark. This is where we are. You don't want to do a survey again until you've had enough time for change to have occurred. If you survey too quickly, it's kind of what's the point? Because your answers might not be different, or you might actually get people right at the start of a change, and then you're getting not necessarily the outcome assessment from people, you're getting the I'm in the middle of it. and I'm not happy about it feedback.
Yeah.
And so you have to be careful in terms of, you know, be strategic about when you plan to do your surveys. Every situation and every environment will have a different answer to that. There isn't one way to do it.
Yeah. Well, and this might then be the answer to that, but you and I in a previous conversation were talking about how organizational readiness is that key factor before taking the step to do an engagement survey. This might be a question that doesn't really have an answer, but how does an organization know if it's ready? Like, how do they know if they have the capacity that, like, if it's the right time to do a survey, what does readiness look like?
Yeah, and the readiness that I think about most isn't necessarily the readiness for the survey. It's the readiness to do something with the information after the survey. The worst thing you can do is survey, get a lot of information, ask for input, make people feel like their voice has an influence, and then do nothing. Because it is certainly demoralizing and can actually work against your culture versus trying what you're trying to do with these is collect information, collect input, have people's voices heard so that when they see change happening, they can see their voice in what is happening. And so if you do nothing, it's essentially saying to them, your voice doesn't matter. And that's not going to be a good outcome for your culture. So the more that you take a look at how much, like survey on the things you have capacity to do something about.
Okay.
So if you have zero capacity to deal with your facility, for example, like let's say people, I mean, I worked at one organization, we were bursting at the seams. And the big joke was, we'll hire you if you own cargo pants because you have to be able to put office supplies in your pockets and walk around and find a desk. Good luck. We were bursting at the seams. Well, that would not have been the time to ask a lot of questions in an engagement survey about the facility. There was nothing we could do. We were on a lease. We were a nonprofit. We couldn't make a change. And anything we were going to do was years in the future. So we had to be careful about what kinds of things we focused on because we could only ask for input on things we knew we could make a difference in. And so we narrowed down, what are we going to focus on? So is it on our values? Well, let's survey around our values, or, you know, how we're living and breathing our values, or, you know, other things that you know that you can do something about. So maybe it's about workload, or maybe it's about flexibility and scheduling and time off or compensation, or, you know, those other kind of areas where maybe you can move the needle on something. And so you ask questions that actually give you the information you need to move something forward. That's your readiness that you need to look at.
And in terms of figuring out that capacity, it sounds like you're going to be working with multiple departments to help that would actually be implementing the capacity. So how much when designing these surveys do those departments have a say in putting together the questions, or like what does collaboration on it look like or not?
Yeah, well, depending on the survey outcomes that you're looking for and the type of survey you're using. So for a pulse survey, for example, it is what it is. You know, you've got two questions. You've got a happy face, sad face. So there's not a lot of collaboration there. That is what it is. On some of the larger, more multifaceted surveys, you can certainly collaboration is good. Where I have seen things fall apart and not get implemented is the collaboration to get to the questions. What questions are we going to ask? What areas are we going to move, ask for input on? You can't get departmental agreement necessarily.
Yeah.
So sometimes what organizations will do is they'll have a set of questions that are broad enough. It doesn't matter what department you're in, that it's going to apply. And then you have like a certain amount of questions that are more department specific, perhaps, or focused on things that where there's more free text. And so you can get people's input, and it might be different from like a facilities department to the development department to production department, you know, that kind of thing. And so you use your free text to kind of give a little bit of space for people's unique environments to kind of show through. But because there are overall surveys about overall organizations, you're not going to dig too deep into uniquenesses across departments. one of the things to do at the beginning of your surveys is to make sure you're asking enough demographic information to be able to do what we call slice and dice your information. So asking, especially if your organization is large enough, asking information about what department are you in, how long have you worked here, so that you can say, well, people who've been here more than 15 years feel like this. People that work in this department feel like this. You can break your data down based on the demographic. That's where departments really can shine through in terms of getting information that's really helpful for them. It's not so much in the question design. It's in the breaking it down. Now, you always have to manage confidentiality and size and scale of your sample size to make sure that you're not breaking confidentiality from anybody, that you're not providing information that's identifiable, so that people trust the information and that the sharing is done in a good way because that trust is there.
I was going to say that seems to be a common feedback that I hear from people is their hesitancy to fill in those surveys because, well, I'm on a team of 8 people and maybe, certain of these, I'm the only one that's been here more than 3 years. So I don't want to have an adverse reaction from my manager if I'm giving challenging feedback kind of thing. Yeah, it's I don't know how you get around that, but it because you obviously want people to be filling them in, but you don't want to discourage people through that slice and dice process as well.
That's right. Yeah. And so your communication strategy when you're sharing with the organization that you're embarking on a survey, and how is the data being managed? How is confidentiality being protected? Making sure you're clear on confidentiality versus anonymity, that, making sure your survey questions are designed in a way that you can't identify who has completed and said what. But it comes down to that communication strategy and telling people that sample size will be considered or sample size will be monitored to ensure that departmental size isn't identifiable or, I mean, there's every organization's different. The point is spending time on that communication strategy at the front to make sure that you're building in the validity and integrity to the process, and then telling people that you've done that so that they know that you've thought about these things and you've considered these things in the design process is helpful to build trust. And then follow through with that after, like the other pieces. And then do not get a report that shows only 3 people and you can tell who it is. And then that, integrity of then people know that, well, you said you weren't going to do that, but you did it anyway. You don't want that showing up. You, when you say you're not going to look at sample sizes smaller than 15 or whatever, then that's what you look at and that's what you work with. So that helps people trust it the next time you go to do it because they saw how well it was managed the first time. So some of it is also you build trust through the experience.
It's interesting that you talk about like the communication process because I think that is such a critical thing. You want that balance of we are encouraging enough people to fill this out so we get enough information, but we have to follow through so that when we communicate what the results have been, that it's not dissent and frustration, right? And I think when we were talking last time about how to communicate the results, you were saying not to do it so frequently, like every quarter, because you might not have information to report back on. But on the flip side, if you're an employee who goes, well, it's been 6 months and I've only heard one update, like how do you manage that? How would you suggest managing that in terms of communication?
Yeah, so that the there's a few communication milestones, let's say. So your first milestone is when you are going to be initiating the project. And I would suggest that you tell people, we're going to do a survey in the next quarter. And so you give them lots of time to let them know, and it'll be distributed by X date. So they know it's coming, so that it's not, if something, the reason for that is that if there's something going on in the organization and then, oh, look at that, suddenly they're doing a survey. It's like, no, we've been planning this for months. Now we're initiating it, regardless of what's going on in the environment right now. So that's a communication milestone, a milestone that the survey is closed and that, what happens now? So obviously you need time to analyze the results and, to interpret the report, and to identify what are the next steps. So then at the closure, then telling people what, when should they expect the next update? So the next update might be the start of the next quarter, or within a month, or within 3 months, whatever is reasonable, depending on the size of the survey, to let people know this is what phase we're in now, and this is what we'll be doing in this phase. We'll be analyzing the results and looking at the reports, and we will report back to you at this juncture. That's your next milestone. Then you're then at that milestone, then you might be saying, okay, we've parceled out the results, and we have, as a result, three projects that we're initiating in the next year. We're going to do workload analysis, we're going to do time management training, and we're going to do manager training. That might be what comes out of the survey. And here's when we expect them to happen. Then people are like, okay, so that's what we're doing with those results. If something goes awry and you hit a milestone and you're not where you thought you were, you still need to do an update. Mm-hmm. So then the update becomes, we haven't gotten as far along as we thought we would. We're analyzing, or we're taking this next step, and you'll get a next update from us at this point. And so it's really just letting people know, not that we've got the results and they're so bad that we don't want to talk about them, so we're just going to quietly sweep this under the rug and never talk about it again. There's always a milestone marker where you're having updates, and it might be, we're not as ready as we thought we were to release the data. And so we need another month or whatever the case might be. Mm-hmm. But you're still holding true to your milestones so that you continue to build trust, because the trust that you're building in this process, and the sense of safety for people, and the tying it to the well-being piece, the sense of security that you're building for people, isn't just for this survey. It's for this survey and the next one and the next one and the next one. And so everything you do in that first round is building people's experience of what it's going to be like the next time you do this as well. Mm-hmm. And so the more you can communicate, the more you can inform, the more you can have transparency, the better your involvement will be. Like, you might have a response rate of 60% on your first one. Your goal is to grow that in your next one. And the way to grow that is by having that integrity to your process throughout your first one, so that people are like, oh, maybe I can trust this process. This time I will respond, because I didn't trust it last time. Mm-hmm. But then I watched it, right? People watch what's going on. They watch how you behave. They watch how you communicate. They watch that for that year. And then the next one comes out, they're more likely to respond. So the milestone, mapping out your milestones when you've done, as you design that first communication strategy plan, that's when you map your milestones of communication, so that you know, this is when we're going to talk about things, and people know this is when we're going to update you. So there's no questions, there's no secrets.
Yeah.
Everybody's up and up on, you know, what's happening and what's coming.
It's funny because it sounds so simple, but we know simple is not always easy. And it goes back to what you're saying, right, about capacity, right? You can so easily see how at many organizations this falls apart because of a lack of capacity to get that communication together. And it's not ill intent, hopefully in most cases, but it's that, oh, we got so busy with other things, we lost track of this, we forgot to do an update, and the impact that can have. So yeah, going back to what you said about readiness and capacity, critical first step.
Mm-hmm. And I think the more you can front load your planning, mm-hmm. The better. So not just planning your launch communication, but your closure communication, your first update communication, planning your timelines for that, planning what are you going to say? Who's going to say it? Is this something that the CEO needs to be communicating? Is this coming from HR? Like, make those plans right at the beginning. And so everybody who needs to be involved is identified right at the beginning. And then that helps you identify, are we ready? Because if you can't get that plan in place, then there's a question about whether you're ready for hundreds of data points to come at you, and to take the time to analyze and identify what are we going to do with this information, and where are we going to go with this next, mm-hmm. and update people on it. If you can't get your ducks in a row at the beginning, what makes you think you can get your ducks in a row at the end, right? So if that's hard, then you know you need to build in more time, you need to build in more, flexibility to your timelines, because you know that organizationally we're struggling to get this designed.
Yeah. Let's say hypothetically, you're an organization that knows you have high levels of stress and you're seeing people go on stress leave, you're seeing burnout being really high. But getting to the root issue of any of that is incredibly difficult, right? Because it could be a myriad of root causes that's leading to this. How then do you go about designing a survey when you know the problem, but it could be one of many root issues? Does that just mean you're surveying on multiple topics? Like, if you wanted to get to the root of stress in an organization, what would you include on that survey?
Well, we take a look at things like workload, management influence, work balance, like, is there a work-life balance? Is there psychological safety? So there's like different factors that we look at and that are pretty standardized across any organization that we're working with. It doesn't matter what industry you're in, doesn't matter what professionals or frontline staff, it's all the same. And so, yeah, there's six or seven different components. And then it's things like, do you feel valued in the workplace? Do you feel informed? Do you feel like you have control over your schedule? The things that we know contribute to stress, contribute to burnout, contribute to workload, and contribute to dissatisfaction, disengagement, lack of trust. You know, those are the, and there's some standardized factors. It's the, how is it showing up and to what degree that the engagement survey starts to give you? Because you can intuitively know, this starts to give you a little bit more data on it. Because each factor area would have three or four questions associated with it.
And I'm sure in some ways it's probably easier if those issues are contained to a department, right? Because you can then work with that department lead to sort of figure out next steps. But if it's pervasive in an organization, who then takes the reins on that? Like, what role does HR play in trying to help manage those issues? What role do the department leads play if it's an organizational wide issue?
Well, I mean, it's a multi-pronged approach. There's no one person or role that's responsible. Everybody has a role to play. So, and it depends on like, what are the things underneath it? So is it communication and the way we communicate? Is it the fact that we have a lack of systems, tools to do our work? Is it that we've got an organizational design factor, like the departments aren't organized properly? So different results will tell you, like, who's got the priority role here? Is it HR because they need to come up with systems and structure? Is it department leads and them needing more training or more clarity of roles and responsibilities? So it's the results that tell you who needs to be involved. Company-wide initiatives really benefit from cross-departmental advisory groups or working groups. And it's not just all held by HR, and HR makes the decisions and then says, hey, you over there, you know, go do this. Getting as much input and involvement from those that see the work on the ground in any kind of solution design development is important, because you can do it from the, you know, the corner office, or you can do it from people who see the work every day and see what the bumps look like. And when they see the results, take a look and go, oh, so that's what that looks like. Here's how this shows up on the floor. Here's how this shows up in the office or in the Zoom meetings or in the inability to get a product finished and out the door on time. Here's where that problem is showing up, and this is the outcome. So as many people that have the ability to see that in play out need to be involved in that coming up with the solution part.
And it's like, I don't envy organizations the process of reviewing these, because you see, you know, you see organizations that, let's say, they are having a real culture issue. And so they're like, well, back to the office is going to be the result, the fix for that. And really, it's a much deeper issue, but you're kind of like slapping what you think is the Band-Aid on it. Like, it's, I like what you're saying about having a cross-functional approach to resolving this, and also multiple levels, because you get that insight that, you know, I would have jobs where my manager had no idea what I did, or my manager's manager didn't know what I did, or what the impact of a change would be. And so like none of this is easy, but it's, you know, when organizations can take that time and really, and time and money and all that stuff, but it like it's not, I don't envy the process in short.
And I mean, assuming best intent, you know, as you talked about earlier, sometimes when we do surveys and then we do the analysis for the organizations, we set out, you know, here's our recommendations, and then we prioritize, because you cannot do it all at once. And it's really challenging for an organization if you've got one department trying this and another department trying that and a different department trying that. Everybody's trying to, you know, move the needle to that one outcome. And so the more that you can coordinate, the better, so that there isn't a sense of chaos going on in the organization. But the other thing is that sometimes it's important to take a step back and say, we think we know what we're talking about and what we're doing, so let's pilot it.
Yeah.
And let's take one part of the organization and try it. Maybe we've got it nailed and this is actually going to make the difference. And maybe we are totally off the mark. But we only once we tried it did we realize that we were missing information, or there was a gap in our assumptions or something. And so taking some baby steps with piloting, with, you know, trialing things can be helpful to kind of manage that chaos of overwhelm of like, there's so much to take a look at here. You cannot do it all. The outcome of these surveys is not meant to throw the organization into chaos and stress and to really just add more work to people's plates. The goal is to actually inform in a way that you can actually manage those pieces better, that you can help take some of that stress away, and not have it be sort of this overwhelming sense of like, well, we did the survey and now we're inundated with all these new projects and all these new ways of doing things, and everybody's kind of like, oh my gosh, what's going on?
Would you do those pilots with groups who are fairly stable or who maybe need it more, but the risk and reward is higher?
It would very much depend on what it's about.
Yeah.
And
okay.
The safety in the team, the competency of the manager, the like, how dramatic is it that what we're trying to do? And all those things would need to be considered. It's not, there isn't a like an easy, just, you know, oh, take your, you know, highest functioning team and pilot things. The highest functioning teams piloting things don't always give you what you need to learn from a pilot. And so, yeah, you really would want to take a look at, well, what is it that this pilot is about? And who's going to give us the best input on whether this is going to work or not?
Yeah. I often think of the challenges that are faced by frontline managers with engagement and stress in the organization overall as well, because often frontline managers are maybe first-time managers as well. Mm-hmm. And I think you can see a lot of situations where they're getting good survey results from their team about their management style, like, and their connection to that leader, but that there is a disconnect to the organization as a whole. And we see that, right? Psychologically unsafe organizations can have psychologically safe teams within them. So what would be your recommendations to those managers of like what they can do to help manage the stress of their team when maybe the organization as a whole has so far to go?
Well, I guess it depends on what the stress is about. Certainly, you know, staying connected to your team. You know, I'm a big fan of transparency, of information sharing where you can. Obviously, confidentiality needs to be maintained where needed. But information can be very powerful for people. In that, not that it's like power, positional power with information. I mean, there is that. It's a whole other thing. But it can be empowering to have information and can help manage the uncertainty, manage the instability, manage anxiety, manage, you know, a sense of being out of control. And those are the things that cause stress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's different kinds of stress, and I'm by no means an expert on stress. But I look at it from the point of view of there's performance stress and then there's emotional stress.
Yeah.
And performance stress can be a good thing. It can be what gives us, you know, that high performing, I'm going to take this to the next level kind of energy. Emotional stress is what gets us into places of anxiety and depression and burnout, and is can take us into the not so pleasant parts of stress. And information can help us manage both of those. It can give us the information we need to move us into that next level of performance from a positive stress point of view. And it can help quell the fears that bring up the emotional stress in the negative, and instead bring us more positive feelings in our managing our stress. So sharing information, being transparent, having those one-on-one meetings with your team to help share that information, sharing information equitably across your entire team, being transparent. What do you know? What don't you know? You don't know. You don't know. But as soon as you know, you will share. Building that trust that if you can share, you will share. And so again, quelling the uncertainty, quelling the, I'm going to get blindsided. I'm going to get shocked. I'm going to be surprised. The more that we can manage those feelings, the easier it is for people to manage their performance stress, or their anxiety stress, and manage the other parts of stress. So that frontline manager role is key to being able to, because they have information sometimes that can make a big difference. And so finding places and spaces to share that information as a frontline manager can really support a team who might be seeing and hearing from other places in the company things that don't jive with what they're hearing in their department. So the trust with the manager, because the information sharing is happening, starts to manage those pieces of stress.
Yeah. It's interesting because I remember reading an article recently, I think it was in Forbes, that like a shockingly high percentage of managers have never, like frontline first-time managers have never had any managerial training. Are there any kind of like resources or books or whatnot where you're like, if I was talking to a first-time manager, I'd say, read this, do this, go forth and conquer.
Right. Well, I mean, this, I didn't know you're going to ask me this question. This is a quote plug for our training. So at Engaged, we have a number of trainings on lots of different HR things, like how to give feedback, how to do performance management, how to interview properly, good communication skills. And one of the courses we have is about people management. And it's for people managers, people who have direct reports that are newer in their people management career. And they're trying to figure out and navigate that, you know, I now have people reporting to me, what do I do? And sometimes it's people that used to be peers, like we were colleagues, and now I've been promoted and they haven't, and now they report to me. How do I navigate those conversations? Because now I'm giving feedback. And before we used to, you know, sit in the kitchen and just talk about work, and now I'm their boss. So that course is great for managing and understanding yourself, because a big part of managing others is managing yourself. And knowing yourself and managing yourself first, and then managing individuals and them and your relationship with them, and then managing teams and your relationship, their relationship with each other and their relationship with you. And so this course, Essential People Management, is basically managing yourself, managing individuals, and managing teams for the newer supervisor. So that's my go-to. That's the one that I love to promote.
Is it virtual or is it in person?
It's virtual. Yeah.
Oh, great.
So yeah, it's a 4 half-day, 3 hours. So it's 12 hours of training, 4 half-day sessions. And it's, yeah, it's done virtually. So anywhere, anybody, anywhere can take the course. You don't have to be local to where we are in Victoria, BC. Perfect. You can be anywhere.
Well, I will link to it in today's show notes so you can go and find that. And yeah, because I think it's such a struggle for people, and they think they assume they will get that within their organization, and it just might not happen. So it's a fantastic resource. Any other like top books or?
Well, one of the ones that I love is Radical Candor, but of course I can't remember who wrote it.
We will find it and we will link to it.
So Radical Candor is great. Depending on your style, like I think this goes back to really understanding yourself and your own style and being comfortable with your style. I do follow a lot of Brené Brown's work and a lot of her work on vulnerability and being comfortable with being who you are is really important. And so do follow a lot of hers, like Daring Greatly and Gifts of Imperfection, and as well as Dare to Lead. I mean, Dare to Lead's kind of the leadership one, but there's the self-work comes through other work that she's done as well.
Yeah, love it. So before we wrap things up, I'm very conscious of time. What's your overall take on workplace well-being programs? Like I know we know that individual employee, like programs that focus on individual employees' actions very rarely work, but are there any practices that you encourage with your clients from an HR and organizational perspective that like help when it comes to workplace well-being?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's so many different options out there. And so this is a huge topic. And I think the thing that that resonates the strongest for me, and certainly within our organization, is the normalizing of well-being and the validating that we all need to work on this. Nobody has it nailed down perfectly. Nobody has it, you know, like a walk in the park. Everybody has a story. Everybody has things that they're dealing with, and normalizing those conversations and the comfort level with things like vulnerability and saying like, I'm having a tough time, then your programs can actually do something because there's no stigma. There's no judgment. There's no fear of utilizing and accessing and availing themselves of those tools because it's been normalized that we need to take care of our well-being, and that looks different for everybody. And so, you know, we do a lot of the normalizing work, and then we leave and so then what is it that you need? We provide lots of options, but also leave it to the employee to determine what's going to work for them. So we're not forcing a particular methodology of wellness or well-being onto people, because that's what works for those that designed the program. But instead normalizing, saying, you do you in what you need, and it's okay to need something. And here's what we can offer. And if you need something else, then let's talk about what that might be and how we can support you in that. And that's where we kind of take the well-being conversation. And then we also have some fun with it. You know, I mean, just recently we have a health and wellness committee, and our health and wellness committee issued a cartoon about what it means to be in HR when it's, you know, it's a tough industry right now. We are being asked to really rise up to a lot of really interesting situations. And so, you know, sending out, making it funny, making it, you know, normalizing, like sometimes it is insane what we have to deal with, and things you never thought you'd ever in your career have to deal with are on your plate all at the same time. And so that's kind of the approach that we take, is how do we normalize this? How do we, you know, take some of the pressure out of it, like let the air out of the balloon a little bit on it. And then how do we make sure that people know that we have supports available, and if they need something different, we're totally open to a conversation around that. Because it has to be what works for them. It can't be just what we think is going to work for them.
Yeah. And I love what you're saying about normalizing it, because we all, I mean, that's why I start all these episodes with what's stressing you out. Cause like, it's that normalizing of like, we're all stressed. We've all got stress going on at different levels. It's that degree and like that ebb and flow of everything. And it's, I mean, the same with workplace well-being and engagement. And it's like you're saying with those pulse surveys, you might catch me on a bad day when I fill in that pulse survey, and it's not representative of my time with the organization as a whole. So having these different opportunities, to me, like the overall feeling of an engagement survey from someone who like likes to look at the results is like, it's opportunity. It's opportunity for growth. It's also an opportunity to let you as the employee let people know what's not working. But on the flip side, if we don't know what's not working, we can't make a difference. We can't see those improvements. Like, I find them hopeful, but I might be just an optimist here.
No, it's an excellent point, because what we haven't talked about is in all of this accountability and being prepared for the next steps and what you're doing, your communication strategy also needs to talk about the celebrations of what's gone well. You can't only talk about that, because that will come across as very naive, or, you know,
we fixed it. It's done.
Non-transparent. Like, like, look how great we are. Everything's wonderful. When people in reality know that's not true. So it will come as very inauthentic if everything is golden and beautiful. So you have to balance it, but you also can't only focus on the things that need to be worked on. You need to stop and celebrate what is working well. People need the balance in the feedback. They need to know that not everything is broken, because it might feel like that. You're going to get a lot of feedback, and you, you know, we all have been there. You sit in a performance review and you get a ton of great feedback, and that one thing you could work on. What do you think we obsess about? That one thing. So engagement surveys can create that same feeling for people. I'm going to get all this information. I'm going to obsess about the things that need to be fixed and disregard or discount the things that are going really well. And so we need to make sure that we're balancing our feedback back out into the organization. Like, we're super happy with these elements and, you know, thrilled that this is going well. And we don't want to break, fix what's not broken. This stuff is staying the same. And we've got some areas we could improve or areas we could make some changes to increase people's satisfaction or engagement or whatever. So here's the two or three things we're going to do. Not 150, you know, not 75. Here's our next 2 quarters. These are the two things we're going to do. Be reasonable, be very measured in how much you take on, so that you can actually complete it and, you know, get to that end result. So then you're celebrating the great and you're seeing progress on something else. And yeah, not everything's going to get fixed, but you've got then an emphasis on growth and change and keeping what's working, while you measure and prioritize what you can work on. So that celebration also helps manage stress. It also helps people's well-being, to remember to have those celebration moments as you go, and those milestones that are like, here's what we did achieve, here's what we did accomplish, also helps people feel like, okay, we're making progress, and progress is very helpful for stress management. Very, very helpful.
Well, Denise, thank you so much for your time and your insights. It's been so fabulous having you on the podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you for the invitation. I really enjoyed chatting with you today.
Big thank you to Denise for joining me on the podcast, and I hope you got as much out of it as I did. As I mentioned, everything that we've discussed today you can find in the show notes, including links to connect with Denise on LinkedIn, as well as following the various different courses and offerings that Engaged have. We are not far off the end of our season on workplace well-being, just an episode or two left. So I hope that you've enjoyed this journey that we've been going on. And I have to say, it's always such a delight to hear from podcast listeners. I had one of you very kind listeners reach out to me on LinkedIn last week and say how helpful some of these episodes have been. And it was just absolutely an incredible experience. You might be surprised how rare it is for a podcast host to hear from their listeners, you know, especially if you don't hang out on social media all that often. So it was such a pleasure. So thank you so much for tuning in, and I can't wait to connect with you next week. Take care.